Number two, in audio letter 73 last month, I described Project Z, the new Bolshevik three-phase strategy for nuclear war one. An elite group of American Bolshevik military planners here are fleshing out the plan right now at a secret war room here in Washington. It's a plan by which the United States will strike the first nuclear blow, followed by all-out thermonuclear war with Russia. Having set off the Holocaust, the Bolsheviks here and in certain other countries plan to ride it out, safe and comfortable war bunkers. Finally, after nuclear war one fizzles out in stalemate, they plan to leave behind the ashes of the United States and her allies. Activating phase three of their grand strategy, they plan to unveil their secret weapons, especially their secret naval fleets. With these, they plan to conquer and rule what is left of the world. The United States, as we know it, will be dead and gone. But in the eyes of the Bolsheviks themselves, this outcome will constitute victory. Up to now, the nuclear war timetable, which I first revealed 2 months ago, is still on track. They are still shooting for a nuclear war to begin by September of this year, 1982. Time is fast running out. The Bolsheviks here are sprinting as fast as they can toward war. But, my friends, the Bolsheviks are not the only runners in this race. They have two deadly enemies, both of whom are equally determined to trip up the Bolsheviks. One enemy of the Bolsheviks here is the Rockefeller cartel. The other enemy is the new anti-Bolshevik ruling clique in Russia. And now these two mutual enemies of the Bolsheviks are pooling their efforts in certain ways. In audio letter 71 3 months ago, I reported that a limited new anti-Bolshevik coalition was in the works between the Rockefeller cartel and the Russians. The January 26 meeting between Haig and Gromyko in Geneva, Switzerland, was a turning point in the formation of this coalition. It is now a reality and is responsible for the so-called Falkland crisis now dominating the headlines. It should be emphasized that this new relationship between the Rockefeller cartel and Russia falls far short of a true alliance. They have very major disputes to be settled between them, but for the time being, they have called a truce between themselves to deal with their mutual deadly enemy, the Bolsheviks here in America. The first priority of the Russians and the Rockefellers is to slow down the Bolshevik preparations for imminent nuclear war. If they can do that, time is on the side of the Rockefeller cartel and certain political movements which I discussed last summer in audio letter 67. A slowdown in the nuclear war timetable will also give more breathing space for additional anti-Bolshevik actions to be implemented. The joint Rockefeller-Russian planners decided by mid-February that military action against the Bolsheviks was essential very quickly. No other type of action had any hope of taking effect fast enough to prevent nuclear war by the end of the summer. The exact details of the Project Z war plan are not known to either the Rockefellers or the Russians, but the general outlines are known to be as I described last month. It was decided that military action should be devised that would undermine Phase 3 of the Bolshevik war plan. That is, the Bolshevik-controlled secret naval installations and fleets in the Southern Hemisphere should be attacked and crippled. By working together, the Rockefeller cartel and the Russians were able to devise an attack plan which neither could have carried out alone. The Rockefeller group, who built and originally controlled these bases, provided detailed intelligence about the best way to attack them. The Russians, with their enormous military machine, provided the muscle to actually carry out the attack. It was essential to devise a scheme that would enable both secret fleets in the South Atlantic and South Pacific to be attacked. Survival intact of either fleet would leave the Bolshevik war plan still workable. Military analysts concluded very quickly that a direct assault on the New Zealand facilities was out of the question. There was no combination of commandos, frogmen, or other military force which could possibly keep an attack secret from the outside world. Any attack on the New Zealand bases would set off the very war which the Rockefellers and Russians want to prevent. But the situation in the South Atlantic was a different matter. In a way, the greatest asset of South Georgia Island was also its Achilles heel. The extreme isolation which protected the secrecy of the South Georgia base also made a covert military assault feasible. The key lay with Argentina and her long-standing claims to the Falkland Islands. As I mentioned in topic number one, the Rockefeller cartel has dominated all of Latin America for decades. Cartel operatives were sent to Argentina to work out a deal with a government military junta there. The historic dispute over the Falkland Islands was to be used to provide a ruse, a military cover, to enable the South Georgia base to be attacked. The Argentine generals were not told everything about the situation by any means, but they were told enough to make clear what they were to do. As an inducement to cooperate, the Argentine leaders were promised handsome rewards. They were guaranteed that after the shooting was over, the Falkland Islands would remain in Argentine hands. This guarantee included the promise of covert military assistance as needed against the Royal Navy. And to bolster the troubled Argentine economy, it was promised that the Rockefeller cartel will help develop the immense offshore oil reserves. With these combined promises of military glory and financial rewards, the Argentine military junta agreed to the plan. On March 19, Argentina carried out Act 1 in the joint attack plan. A group of Argentine scrap metal merchants, of all things, landed at the abandoned old whaling station on South Georgia Island. Supposedly, they were there to dismantle the old buildings and cart them off to sell. While they were at it, they also raised the Argentine flag over the worksite. The British, always nervous about South Georgia Island, promptly reacted as expected. The British Antarctic Survey ship Endurance put 22 Marines ashore. They drove off the scrap merchants and tore down the Argentine flag. The incident provided the desired excuse for the Argentine junta to bring the simmering 150-year-old Falklands dispute to a boil. From time to time in the past, Argentina has claimed that South Georgia is part of the Falklands because it is administered that way by Britain. That argument is very flimsy, but it now came in very handy. It was nothing new to hear this from Argentine leaders, so there was no hint of what was really afoot. During late March, Argentine military forces started assembling for an assault on the Falklands. Nothing new, thought the British High Command. Argentina has carried out threatening maneuvers in the past many times. It was believed that they were about to do it again. But on April 2nd, Argentine forces did the unexpected. After many past false alarms, this time they actually invaded and seized the islands. All Argentine public statements emphasized the long-standing historical claims to the Falklands themselves. But just for good measure, the next day a small Argentine force also seized far-off South Georgia Island. The force was so small that it gave the appearance initially that it was just a sideshow from Argentina's point of view. However, the small contingent of 22 Royal Marines were overpowered and bundled off the island, along with a group of 13 alleged scientists. That was the moment of payoff in the joint Rockefeller-Russian attack plan. Thanks to the elaborate distraction staged by the Argentine forces, a special commando team got onto the island undetected. Based on the detailed Rockefeller information about the base, the team moved to a location on the mountain directly above the cavernous secret base. Special high-speed drilling equipment was set up by the Rockefeller members of the team, while the Russian members concentrated on military defense. By late that evening, April the 3rd, the military high command in London finally learned what was really taking place. The secret South Georgia base was under attack by virtually the only means possible. The joint Rockefeller-Russian team were drilling a shaft down through the mountain toward the hollowed-out cavern inside. It was only a matter of time until the drill would break through the ceiling of the giant hidden naval base. Once the hole was made, the next step was obvious. The Rockefeller-Russian team would put a weapon of some kind through the hole. The best guess was that it would be a nerve gas. The shock waves that went through the highest levels of the British government on the evening of April 3rd can hardly be described, my friends. The Thatcher government, like the so-called Reagan administration here in America, is Bolshevik-controlled. That's why Margaret Thatcher always says, "Me too," anytime the Reagan administration says or does anything against Russia. Both governments are party to the secret nuclear war plan, in complete betrayal of the people of their respective countries. And on the evening of April 3rd, they suddenly discovered that their precious war plan was in deep, deep trouble. Immediately, the Thatcher government started assembling a naval armada to sail for the South Atlantic. Haste was the order of the day. The drilling on South Georgia Island was proceeding around the clock. The best estimates were that the drilling would break through into the roof of the naval base in about 3 weeks, on or about April 24th. If help did not reach South Georgia by then, the secret installation might be doomed. The forces stationed at the installation itself were unable to defend themselves under the circumstances. Their mighty naval ships were ships in a bottle. They did not dare open the bottle to sail out to fight because the Russian commandos were armed with tactical and nuclear weapons. To open the blast-proof entrance doors would be suicide. On April 5, just 2 days after South Georgia Island was seized, some 40 naval ships began moving out of British ports. Same day, Lord Carrigan was sacked as foreign minister. He was forced to resign, my friends, because he had assisted the Rockefeller attack plan by downplaying the Argentine attack preparations. That same day, April 5, New Zealand, the home of the other secret naval fleet, broke diplomatic relations with Argentina. The two hidden New Zealand facilities had been placed on red alert. As a precautionary measure, all submarines at the twin base were ordered to sea. Several surface ships were already at sea, undergoing sea trials. But that still left 7 major ships inside the hidden twin naval base, including one of the nuclear aircraft carriers I mentioned earlier. On that busy day of April 5, Argentina's Foreign Minister Costa Mendez was at the United Nations in New York. He was alarmed by the deployment of such a large part of the Royal Navy. Costa Mendez hurried here to Washington to seek reassurances from certain officials. He got them. For the next 2 weeks or so, the news was filled with stories about the allegedly slow movement of the British fleet while negotiations went on. That, my friends, was only a cover story. The Royal Navy was actually joining up and moving as rapidly as possible towards South Georgia Island. If the task force arrived in time to save the secret base, a major battle was likely. The official stories about slow movement of the British Armada were intended to give a cushion of time for that battle. If need be, the fleet would have several days to retake South Georgia Island. Then it could move on to arrive near the Falklands on the announced schedule. In this way, the crucial importance of South Georgia Island would be hidden and the big secret preserved. It was initially expected that advance elements of the British fleet would reach the vicinity of South Georgia Island within 2 weeks. That would have been soon enough to attack the joint Rockefeller-Russian commando team and stop the drilling before it was completed. But Russian Cosmospheres and submarines made a shambles of the plan. Key advance elements of the South Georgia attack contingent left Ascension Island early April 14, 2 days before it was announced officially. Shortly after they did so, they ran into trouble. Russian Cosmospheres and attack submarines closed in on a single ship, which was critical to the planned counterassault on South Georgia Island. The Cosmospheres bombarded the bridge and combat information center of the ship with neutron radiation. In moments, the ship was without any command, its communications and radar silenced. Then a Russian sub closed in and quickly finished off this key British ship with torpedoes. It broke apart with secondary explosions and sank rapidly. So far as is known, there were no survivors. This unexpected shock in the mid-Atlantic produced 2 results, both important. First, it caused a slowdown in the race toward the South Atlantic by the British Armada. The task force had to be regrouped into a configuration better suited for an en route defense, but that cost valuable time. Public announcements from London about the progress of the fleet reflected this slowdown. The timetable for arrival on battle stations near the Falklands started stretching out longer and longer. All this bought extra time for the joint commando team on South Georgia Island. The drilling continued. The other result of the sinking was equally important. Word was flashed to the South Pacific Stealth Navy to prepare for possible action. It was obvious that the Russian Navy was getting involved in the Atlantic, which meant that the Royal Navy could be in big trouble. During the dead of night, early April 15, the seven stealth ships put to sea from their twin secret bases in southern New Zealand. They deployed to a secret operational headquarters area in the Antipodes Islands, 450 miles southeast of New Zealand. Their electromagnetic shields were operating to provide protection from attack. These shields make it impossible to communicate with the outside world or even to see it, as I explained last month. But once they arrived at the Antipodes, the stealth ships hooked up to buoys equipped with shielded communication cables to the island headquarters. The Antipodes headquarters, in turn, was in constant touch with South Georgia Base by way of a transoceanic cable around the tip of South America. The deployment of the available ships of the South Pacific Stealth Fleet was exactly what the joint Rockefeller-Russian planners had hoped for. The ships had been flushed out from their essentially invulnerable hiding place in New Zealand. A British ship sinking of April 14 was also followed by other events. On April 15, the Argentine Navy started moving out of port. The same day, Alexander Haig arrived again in Buenos Aires. Supposedly, he was there as a diplomat, but in reality, he was there as a general dealing with generals. Haig is the top governmental operative of the Rockefeller cartel, as I have revealed in the past. He was making sure that the Argentines did not get cold feet and back down at that critical moment. 4 days later, April 19, Haig left for Washington. As he boarded his plane, Haig somberly told reporters, "Time is running out." And so it was, my friends, for the secret South Georgia base. The very next day, April 20, the drill broke through into the hollowed-out cavern of the naval base. Bolshevik military analysts in London had not expected that it could be completed until at least the following weekend. The British fleet was still out of range. The weapon which the commando team inserted down through the long hole was a small, compact Russian neutron bomb. When it was detonated inside the confines of the huge artificial cave, the effects were devastating. The intense radiation instantly killed everyone inside the base. Also, the heat and blast effects of the bomb are believed to have damaged all the ships inside sufficiently to badly disable them. Meanwhile, Russian cosmospheres and submarines were converging on the stealth ships, which were near the Antipodes Islands, awaiting orders. From a distance, the ships were invisible to the eye due to their protective shields, which also protect against beam weapon attack. But they were sitting ducks for the tactics which the Russians employed. Floating overhead, the cosmospheres located the seven ships using their psychoenergetic range-finding equipment known as PRF. As I have reported in the past, there is no method known by which PRF can be jammed. The cosmospheres radioed the exact locations of the ships to the attack submarines. The subs were armed with special non-homing, non-nuclear torpedoes designed to explode on impact. More sophisticated torpedoes would have been thrown off course or detonated prematurely by the protective shield of each ship. But these simple torpedoes just cruised right through each invisibility field to strike the ship and explode. Within 15 minutes after the attack began, all seven Bolshevik stealth ships were on their way to the bottom. And with them went their Bolshevik commanders and mercenary crews, collected from around the world. The South Pacific action took place just after sunset local time. The time here in Washington was around 2 p.m., April 23. That evening, Secretary of State Haig was seen briefly in public with the new British Foreign Minister, Francis Pym. Pym was wearing the artificial pseudo-smile which diplomats are taught always to display in public, but not Haig. Haig was grinning from ear to ear, and no wonder. The joint Rockefeller-Russia military operation had been a brilliant success. The secret Bolshevik South Atlantic fleet had been virtually wiped out, bottled up inside South Georgia Island. and the South Pacific Fleet, while not totally wiped out, had been badly crippled. By working together, the Rockefeller Cartel and the Russians had won the secret naval war of the Southern Hemisphere. Topic number 3. As I say these words, news reports give the impression that war is about to erupt in the South Atlantic. But the real war in the Southern Hemisphere is already over. What we are watching now is the beginning of its bloody aftermath. That aftermath is a battle for the Falkland Islands. They have been promised to Argentina as a reward for her role in the secret war. At this moment, the Bolsheviks here in Washington are pressing for a public announcement that the United States will side with Britain. As soon as that takes place, military action will heat up fast around the Falklands. Britain has no choice but to fight. She has already suffered casualties which cannot be explained without a public battle. But by fighting, the Bolsheviks in Britain are running the risk of a humiliating and tragic defeat for the Royal Navy. Meanwhile, the Rockefeller strategists here are now concentrating on a fast-building anti-nuclear war campaign. On all sides now, we are hearing about the so-called nuclear freeze movement. There are documentaries, articles, publicity of all kinds to sensitize us to the terrors of nuclear war. In recent months, there have even been referenda popping up on election ballots dealing with the nuclear war issue. Medical doctors are banding together to warn the public about what would happen if there were a nuclear war. We are being told that all this is just popping up spontaneously. We are now 37 years into the nuclear age, and nothing like this has ever gained so much momentum before. Yet now we are supposed to believe that millions of Americans have spontaneously gotten the same ideas at the same time. If you believe that, my friends, I give up. Movements like this never, and I mean never, develop without leadership, organization, and money, and plenty of it. What we are watching is a Rockefeller public relations machine at work. As I've explained in the past, the Rockefeller cartel cannot afford to let a nuclear war take place. If it does, they will lose everything because they are not in a position to control it. Instead, the deadly enemies of the Rockefeller cartel, the Bolsheviks here, will win out if there is a war. And so the Rockefeller faction is now doing everything in its power to prevent a nuclear war. The present anti-nuclear war orientation of the Rockefeller cartel creates certain temporary common interests between them and Russia. But as Russia's new rulers know very well, this does not spring from any great moral perspective on the part of the Rockefeller group. It's purely a matter of practical necessity right now for the Rockefellers. The Russians regard the United States as a house divided, and they are exploiting that division by working in careful ways with the Rockefellers. Their first priority is to rid the world of the deadly Bolshevik menace of all-out, even suicidal, nuclear war. But once that is done, they know that there will be a day of reckoning with the Rockefeller cartel someday. The Rockefeller group is working toward a definite objective with their new anti-nuclear war propaganda. That objective is renewed power, and power that moves them closer to their old dream of world government. The Bolsheviks here have unwittingly provided fertile ground for the powerful new Rockefeller anti-war campaign. Under Bolshevik control, the so-called Reagan administration has become so hawkish that it's scaring people. The Rockefeller anti-war campaign is designed to capitalize on that latent fear as a tool of power. These days, the smell of war is in the air. The Falklands crisis is helping to make that more intense. The Rockefeller propaganda machine is now paving the way for the argument that surrender of sovereignty is the only way to avoid war. A new super United Nations of sorts is now in the works to fill the bill. It will have teeth. As presently envisioned, the new organization will be based in Geneva, Switzerland. The working name, though this may be changed, is the World Nonproliferation Council. The plan is to bring it into being as the outgrowth of nuclear nonproliferation treaties, but its true purpose will be to use fear, the fear of war, to control us all. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I have reported on the reasons behind the so-called Falkland Islands crisis. The crisis erupted because of secret Bolshevik-controlled naval installations in the Southern Hemisphere. These have been attacked by joint action of the Rockefeller Cartel and the Russians in an attempt to slow down the nuclear war timetable. The attacks were successful, but the results remain to be seen. One result, though, is that the Royal Navy has now been drawn into a trap. Britain's Waterloo at sea may well be at hand. My friends, two factions are struggling for control over our United States, the Rockefeller Cartel and the Bolsheviks. They differ in style, but both seek to control us through fear. If we are ever to rise above their trickery, it must be through the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, our only hope. As the Scripture tells us, our Lord has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and of a sound mind. We must learn to wage peace. As our Lord declared long ago, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.